impactful rulings from the United States Supreme Court. The latest from the High Court as we await the release of important opinions. On this second anniversary of the Dobbs decision, a look at how that momentous ruling has changed the abortion landscape across the country. Our expert panel weighs in.
We are still sticking to what the church has taught us from the beginning about the value of marriage and the nature of marriage itself.
The African Way. We are on the road to look inside the Catholic Church in Kenya, the cultural issue of polygamy, response to the Vatican's call for non-liturgical blessings of same-sex couples, and the large numbers of Kenyans drawn to the faith. And walking on the trail with the National Eucharistic Pilgrims, insights from our own EWTN photographer documenting their faith journeys from coast to coast. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. With the close of this Supreme Court term expected at the end of this month, we are still awaiting major decisions on several potentially blockbuster cases involving abortion, federal regulatory authority, social media content, and whether former President Donald Trump and others can be prosecuted for trying to overturn the 2020 election. In a major opinion this week, we did hear about guns. In a major decision on gun rights this term, the Supreme Court upheld a federal law that prevents people under domestic violence restraining orders from having firearms. The United States versus Rahimi centered around Zaki Rahimi, a drug dealer who was placed under a restraining order after he turned violent during an argument with his girlfriend. He argued that the law violated his Second Amendment rights by blocking him from possessing guns. In an 8-1 decision, the High Court held that the Constitution permits laws that remove guns from people deemed dangerous. In his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that when an individual poses a clear threat of physical violence to another, the threatening individual may be disarmed. Justice Clarence Thomas dissented. For a reaction to this decision, we are joined now by attorney Mark Chenoweth. He is the president and chief legal officer of the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Mark, thank you so much for your time. What precisely does the Rahimi ruling mean when it comes to the Second Amendment, and how significant is it?
You know, I'm not sure it's that significant a case. What the court did was reaffirm the test that it used in Bruin, the history and tradition factors, and it just applied those a little bit differently than the Fifth Circuit had, and suggested that perhaps the Fifth Circuit was looking for a little bit too close an analog of historical regulation that would be similar to the federal law at issue here. The court, in an 8-1 decision, said, no, this is pretty analogous to some regulation that existed earlier in American history, and therefore they upheld it.
As you mentioned, this was an 8-1 decision, but five separate concurring opinions for six justices. What does that reflect about the court's opinion?
Well, I think they all wanted to get a little bit of their view in there about how to do this kind of a test going forward. And so you had Justice Thomas in dissent say that he was really looking for something more specific in the history. You had others like Justice Gorsuch really focus on, well, here's what we're deciding and here's what we're not deciding in this case. Justice Sotomayor wanted to say, well, I didn't like the test in Bruin, but I think that the court has applied it correctly in this instance. Mm.
Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a ban on bump stocks. Your group represented the plaintiff, Michael Cargill. What is your reaction to that ruling? I believe you've said the case goes beyond the issue of guns.
It really does. It wasn't a Second Amendment case, unlike the Rahimi case. Cargill was a statutory interpretation case, and the question really was whether or not the ATF, the regulator, the federal regulator at issue there, could change the definition of machine guns in a way that created new criminal liability for 500,000 bump stock owners. So we were delighted that the court said no. The criminal law writing is the job of Congress. ATF doesn't have the ability to rewrite criminal law via regulation and create this new criminal liability.
These are two big gun cases out of the Supreme Court within the span of just 1 week. What do they say about how the court looks at the issue as a whole?
Well, you know, I think what it means with Rahimi is that we haven't really changed that much, that, that the Bruin test is still the right test. The lower courts maybe need to pay attention to the differences between Rahimi and Bruin itself in terms of how the different federal laws were applied there and draw some lessons from that. The, you know, to me, the Cargill case is the one that has a much more broadly sweeping impact, because what it says is not just to ATF, but to all federal agencies, you better stay in your statutory lane and not try to write regulations that change the meaning of federal statutes.
Really appreciate your legal insight here. Mark Chenoweth, thank you.
Thank you.
2 years ago, on June 24th, 2022, the Supreme Court issued the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling, which overturned Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, eliminating what was called the constitutional right to abortion in the United States. Today, the pro-life movement continues to celebrate that monumental victory for the unborn and mothers. But numerous setbacks remind advocates there is still a lot of work ahead.
Thank you, God, for what you've done.
2 years ago, on a hot summer day in our nation's capital, pro-life advocates received the victory they prayed and worked for since 1973, the overturning of Roe versus Wade. With that decision, the debate over abortion shifted to the states. And in the 2 years since the overturn of Roe, the pro-life movement has faced an uphill battle not only in state legislatures, but with the voters. According to Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, 24 states have moved to protect life and restrict abortion. 20 of these states protect unborn life when a heartbeat can be heard, usually around 6 weeks into a pregnancy. Though four of these laws face legal challenges, Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America's State Public Affairs Director, Kelsey Pritchard, says they save thousands of lives.
That is major progress just in the time span of 2 years. And if you look at those laws in total, they protect an estimated total of 200,902 lives annually.
But across the country, pro-abortion advocates are working to include what they call a right to abortion in their state constitutions. In the past 2 years, six states have seen constitutional ballot losses for life. Abortion will be on the ballot in five states this November, and eight states are considering a ballot initiative on abortion in the coming election. Abortion has become an issue that has galvanized voters, especially younger ones, and could play a huge role at the polls this November. But despite these losses and struggles, Pritchard says that the pro-life movement still has a lot to celebrate, including life-affirming laws that help moms and babies.
We have 14 states this year that passed some sort of pro-life safety net bill, whether it's to increase child care assistance or to extend Medicaid to postpartum mothers in the first full year, or to have some public funding for those pregnancy centers that do so much for women in their time of need.
To discuss the Dobbs anniversary and the state of the pro-life movement today, we are joined now by two prominent national pro-life leaders. Jeannie Mancini is the president of the March for Life Education and Defense Fund, where she proudly directs the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C., the largest annual human rights demonstration in the world. And Chuck Donovan is senior advisor and founder of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, a pro-life research and education group. He has served in a number of pro-life leadership roles over the years and has played a key part in developing pro-life federal and state policies. I am so grateful to have you both here for this discussion as we're marking this two-year anniversary of Dobbs. And I don't want to brush over the significance of that date. How will the Dobbs decision be remembered in the pro-life history books, Chuck?
Well, it's huge. It's a turning point. Americans need to keep in mind that very rarely does the Supreme Court change its mind. But we went 200 years of our history before the court somehow discovered a universal right to absolute abortion in the Constitution. That was the invention. And it took two centuries before anyone noticed. Madison, Jefferson, they knew, Lincoln didn't know it was there. So what happened was the Supreme Court made a huge mistake, affected all states, federal government, And now the court's finally caught up with what the Constitution actually says. We can protect life.
Absolutely. Jeannie, the significance of this anniversary.
I mean, it's massive. Like, here we are 2 years later, and I think still experiencing sort of the cultural reverberation of the overturn of Roe, and there's a lot of confusion about that, like what the overturn actually did allow, what it didn't, et cetera. Yeah. But it's so important. I mean, it's even a spiritual principle to stop and remember for a moment mm-hmm. how incredible it is that this was overturned 2 years ago and what that was like. And all that, I mean, for me, I think about all the collective marchers, the millions of marchers over the years that you know, went before the Supreme Court to show this is not settled law.
And it came on the solemnity of Jesus's Sacred Heart, speaking right. of that spiritual lens. Well, to that point, those reverberations, if you will, 2 years later, how would you describe the moment the mm-hmm. pro-life movement is in today?
Mm-hmm. I'll start. I'd say a little conflicted. You know, we've had some pretty serious losses, certainly when we consider the ballot initiatives. We've even seen some, you know, elected officials separating themselves or wrongly distancing themselves from this a little bit. And, you know, even just, again, the ongoing confusion, whether it's over medical emergencies, and just the overall misunderstanding about that a right to abortion is good for women. Like, it's so wrong.
Yeah.
But we've had lots of victories, too. I mean, many victories. So nearly half of the states in the country have enacted very life-protective laws, which 2 years ago today they couldn't have done. They couldn't. So under the Roe regime, and certainly at the March for Life, one of our victories is our growing state march mm-hmm. initiative. This year we're in 17 states. We never knew when we began that Roe would be overturned in such a short period of time. We began in 2019, so soon we'll be in all 50 states.
That's amazing. Chuck, how would you describe this moment in the pro-life movement?
Well, I think we're catching our breath. You know, we've had a period of 50 years where seven justices of the Supreme Court told us what abortion law would be, all the way through pregnancy, for parental rights, informed consent. And now we're in a situation where the American people have recovered the ability to decide, to legislate, to determine. And we have to relearn the civic habits of debate, persuasion, and engagement. But I'm a little encouraged, although it's bracing, to think about the history of the civil rights movement. We had a civil war, devastating losses and hundreds of thousands of lives, but it was a century later before we had a Civil Rights Act. Interracial marriage was barred in some states until 1967, segregation until 1956. So if you thought you had secured the dignity, equal dignity of slaves in 1865, it took another century before the law saw it. We have to have the same tenacity.
To look at the long game and to know that justice takes time. Sometimes
it takes a long time, and also takes an active participating citizenry. We need to do it for services and support for mothers. We need to do it at the ballot box, and we'll have some defeats along the way. We need to come back from those.
Well, I want to hit on that point. I mean, and you hit on this as well, Jeannie. Since Dobbs, it has been a string of state losses for pro-life ballot initiatives, six losses in a row. We are seeing many Republican lawmakers now downplay their previously strong pro-life stances. Do you see the pro-life issue as a losing issue politically? Or, you know, how are you encouraging lawmakers to stay strong on this?
Well, we can actually look just at some of the most recent campaigns, and we see that the candidates who leaned into this and who were very compassionate about the issue but also called out their opponent very clearly were the ones who won. So this would be like Governor DeSantis, Governor Abbott, Senator Vance. I mean, so there's a number. So really, I mean, statesmen need not be afraid to be on the right side of history in this, and it's just so important to do it with compassion, with stories, and to be clear about where their opponents stand.
Yeah, absolutely. Chuck, I mean, what do you think about this issue politically, and what are your words to lawmakers?
Well, I may be subject to a little bit of the Reagan distortion. I had the honor of working for President Reagan for 8 years. He was strongly pro-life. He got more pro-life as he was in office. He defended right to life in the 1984 election in debate. And he wasn't given to slicing and dicing when you could protect the unborn. And he happened to carry 49 states on a very pro-life platform in 1984. The most important thing I think the public wants is to avoid hypocrisy, stand behind your words, and actually support mothers and babies and families and along with your rhetoric about life. You do that, I think you'll do well.
This is very important in clarifying context, and our panel stays with us as we now pause for a break. When we come back, beyond abortion, to the politically charged issues of IVF, the future of contraception, and the role of pregnancy centers. And later,
we have a crisis of vocations. We have more candidates than the places where they can go.
Too many priests. How can that be? EWTN News in Depth takes you inside the Catholic Church in Kenya. Through the lens of a gifted still photographer on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, we talk to the eye behind these beautiful pictures and hear his strategy on capturing memorable moments of worship.
His motto on the radio is, we talk about things that matter most. That's what his philosophy has always been from the moment I met him.
And reflections of a beloved voice on the EWTN radio airwaves. We will remember colleague and friend Al Cresta. EWTN News in Depth will be right back. We are back with our guests, Chuck Donovan and Jeannie Mancini, to continue our conversation about life after Roe and the impact of the Dobbs decision on its second anniversary. The overturning of Roe has brought to the forefront other topics on fertility and women's health care, namely the role of in vitro fertilization. This is something the pro-life movement is split on. And to that point, the Catholic Church has long taught IVF is morally unacceptable, but that is not a view shared by everyone in the big pro-life movement. Here's Republican Alabama Senator Katie Britt talking about her bill with Texas Senator Ted Cruz to ensure IVF access.
IVF access is fundamentally pro-family. For the millions of Americans who face infertility every year, IVF provides the hope of a pathway to parenthood.
I mean, Jeannie and Chuck, now that Roe is overturned, for the first time in really a profound way, the pro-life movement is forced to address these topics like IVF.
It's true. It's true. I do think that what we're seeing, at least to a little bit of a degree here, is that the Democrats are vulnerable right now in their position because they are, you know, again, for abortion until birth, paid for by your tax dollars in some states, abortion tourism. And that is out of touch with mainstream America. I mean, we know for over 15 years strong that Americans would limit abortion at most of the first 3 months of pregnancy. So 7 out of 10 Americans would do that. That said, and the March for Life does not take a stance on IVF per se. We're not an inherently Catholic organization, but it's so important for people to understand how that process works, that there is massive loss of life. I mean, in the IVF process, 90% of the embryos that are created are lost. Most of that is in the freezing and thawing process, but listen, most Americans do not understand how these processes work, and so it does allow for a wonderful moment to educate about the life, you know, destructive nature of IVF and et cetera.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Chuck, is there anything you want to say about how this is really being part of the political discussion right now?
Well, I think it's so important because the lives of these embryos, whether frozen, implanted and lost, suggested to be donated for experimentation, we think they're of equal value. It doesn't mean the end of IVF. What it does call into question is a process that puts so many lives at risk, 1.5 million destroyed that we know of, and also calls into the possibility of eugenics, where we select certain children. I think we have the right or the ability to select our children. Very dangerous. We need to slow down and debate this thoughtfully.
Absolutely. Something I do want to highlight, some good news in the pro-life movement, really are those pro-life pregnancy care centers. Chuck, I know you've done so much work and research on the abundance of their care for women and children. What role are they playing right now post-Dobbs? And from what you've seen, are pro-life pregnancy care centers, were they prepared to meet this moment?
Well, if we think back to the anniversary of Dobbs, one of the first things that happened were pregnancy centers were physically attacked. Now, I think that's died down a little bit, but it showed the tenor of the times. But they've gone ahead. We just published a report on 2022 and pregnancy centers served almost 1 million clients, had 16 million in-person or virtual visits, performed about 500,000 ultrasounds. They have a 97.4% satisfaction rate from the mothers. Wow. And have they met it? Well, I think we've helped about half the women we need to reach. But that's a good start. We need to keep at it.
Absolutely. We've talked about how, you know, things are a little confusing out there. There are those post-Dobbs reverberations out there, some division and disagreement in the pro-life movement on various issues. Is there a unified goal of the pro-life movement right now? And if so, what is it?
I don't know if I can say if there's a unified goal, but here's what I would say is our goal. And I'm going to guess Chuck and I are unified in this because I'm borrowing this from a Charlotte Lozier Institute report. 60% of women who chose abortion say that they would have chosen life if they had the requisite support that they needed. Our goal should be that 60%. Yeah. You know, whether it's getting the word out there about pregnancy care centers through this report or what have you, our goal should be that 60%. If they had the support, they would choose life. Let's let them know that they've got that support.
Chuck, you get the last word, goal of the movement right now.
Well, I'll speak from my experience of the March for Life. There's nothing more exciting than looking out and seeing 100,000 people who are less than half my age out there marching for life. Now they're going to march in the sunlight as well as in the winter light. And I'm optimistic that they'll stand up and do the right things.
Standing for life in all seasons. Jeannie Mancini, Chuck Donovan, it was a privilege to have you both here. Thank you. Thanks for having us. A federal judge has granted U.S. bishops and other Catholic organizations temporary relief from a new federal abortion rule. The bishops, along with the Catholic University of America and two Catholic dioceses, challenged the Biden administration's mandate that workplaces must provide accommodations, such as time off for appointments and recovery, for employees who obtain an abortion under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, or PWFA. Laura Woke-Slavis, counsel with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and one of the lawyers for the Catholic groups, says the original law does not mention abortion.
Our clients are very happy that they can continue to support the PWFA and all of the good that it does without being forced to compromise or to potentially violate their religious beliefs.
This court order only applies to the select group of Catholic ministries, as well as employers in Louisiana and Mississippi, as litigation continues in the court. But the final ruling could impact Catholic employers nationwide. In a forthcoming document, the U.S. bishops plan to address whether people who identify as transgender can enter religious life in the Catholic Church. Several bishops requested this guidance after the Bishop of Lexington, Kentucky, publicly supported a transgender hermit. The U.S. Bishops Canonical Affairs and Church Governance Committee plans to release the document in the fall. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review, a diplomatic show of force between dictators, the Putin and Kim meeting in North Korea, a major announcement giving hope to illegal immigrants married to U.S. citizens, and the Ten Commandments is coming to some public school classrooms. The public embrace of two of America's biggest foreign adversaries tops the Week in Review. In a defiant rebuke of the West, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a mutual defense pact during a summit this week. North Korea put on an elaborate show of pomp and circumstance for the state visit as thousands waved flags and the two leaders watched a military pass and review, complete with goose-stepping soldiers. The summit was an outward show of defiance for both pariah nations. As international condemnation over the war in Ukraine has isolated Russia, Putin has reportedly relied on North Korea for stockpiles of conventional munitions to fuel the war effort. In exchange, North Korea is believed to be receiving food, fuel, and possible enhanced military technology for its missile and nuclear development program. At the end of the visit, Putin and Kim signed a comprehensive partnership agreement, pledging mutual military assistance in case of armed aggression. Analysts say the pact has the potential to scramble the balance of power in East Asia and make it more difficult to halt North Korea's nuclear ambitions. One of the most sweeping immigration actions enacted in the U.S. in years was announced at the White House on Tuesday. It is designed to help illegal immigrants married to a U.S. citizen who have lived and worked in the United States for a decade or longer. The policy does not grant citizenship, but rather streamlines the application process. Previously, if an undocumented spouse was living in the United States, they often had to leave the country and apply abroad, a process that could take years. Under this new policy, spouses can now apply for legal status without leaving the U.S. Some Republican lawmakers are critical of the protections and wish the White House would take a harsher stance on illegal immigration. But for many migrants, they say the new guidance could spare their family from a painful and lengthy separation.
Oh my God, I don't wish it on anybody. Being separated is just painful. You don't get that time back. So I'm glad President Biden has put this in place, and I look forward to see how many doors are going to open for families who are in limbo, like mine was.
To be eligible, applicants must have lived in the U.S. for 10 years, have been married by June 17th of this year, and pose no security threat. The program will go into effect by the end of the summer. A first-of-its-kind law in Louisiana requires all public schools from kindergarten to university to display the Ten Commandments in classrooms. Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed the bill into law on Wednesday, calling it one of his favorites. The law specifies the size and text of the posters. Numerous groups argue the new law violates freedom of religion and plan to sue the state in response. The Surgeon General of the United States is calling for social media to come with a health warning. He says the popular platforms can be as dangerous and addicting to kids as tobacco and alcohol.
We have to warn parents about what we are seeing in the data, which is that social media is associated with mental health harms for adolescents. The main goal here is to make social media safe. That's going to require Congress to act, and that action cannot come soon enough.
The recommendation points to recent studies that link social media use in teens to anxiety, depression, and even suicide. A health warning, like the one found on cigarette packaging, would aim to not only change behavior, but warn users and parents of the possible risks. Dr. Murthy's urgency in his call for warning labels comes after years of raising the alarm on the impact of tech on children's health. But he cannot put the warning into effect without congressional approval. Starting next spring, student cell phones will be banned in Los Angeles public schools. The board of the nation's second largest school district voted on the measure on Tuesday. A recent study from Pew Research found a majority of teachers say cell phone use is a major distraction in the classroom. Similar school cell phone restrictions are in place or are being considered in other school districts around the country. A once-in-a-life religious experience has turned deadly for hundreds of people. An unusually harsh heat wave, with temperatures soaring as high as 125 degrees, has taken an extraordinary toll on this year's Hajj pilgrimage in the desert of Saudi Arabia. Unnamed Arab diplomats are saying at least 550 people died during the pilgrimage to Mecca, with many more feared dead. Saudi Arabia has taken measures in recent years to help cool pilgrims with misting stations and air-conditioned tents for those holding official permits. But that is not accessible to hundreds of thousands of unregistered pilgrims. Mecca, the birthplace of Muhammad, is considered Islam's holiest city, and Muslims are expected to make a pilgrimage there at least once in a lifetime. Yet, climate scientists say its dangerous heat makes it one of the least hospitable places on Earth. Sad news from our EWTN family, Al Cresta, longtime Catholic radio host, author, and founder and president of Ave Maria Radio, died last Saturday after battling liver cancer. He was 72. His voice could be heard on hundreds of stations across the country on his radio show, Cresta in the Afternoon.
Well, I'm Al Cresta, back for 2 hours, talking about the things that matter most.
With the Bible in one hand and the New York Times in the other, Cresta used his show to hold thought-provoking discussions on everything from politics and culture to church teaching. As he shared in his appearances on EWTN's The Journey Home, Cresta was an evangelical preacher and broadcaster for years before returning to his Catholic faith in the early 1990s. It was in 1997, Cresta teamed up with Tom Monahan, founder of Domino's Pizza and Ave Maria University, to found Ave Maria Radio. Radio, now a major affiliate of EWTN. EWTN News in Depth spoke to Steve Ray, a good friend of Cresta's for more than 40 years and a frequent EWTN guest himself, about their longtime friendship.
He affected thousands, if not even millions, of people's lives for Jesus Christ. And he convinced people that Christianity was true. And it applied not only to your spiritual life, but if Jesus was the Lord of anything, he was the Lord of everything. That is the perfect description of Al Cresta, having known him for over 40 years. And it never changed one bit during that whole time.
Cresta also helped Ray and his family convert to Catholicism. You can hear that story on our social media pages. Cresta is survived by his wife of nearly five decades, his five children, and many grandchildren. Join us in praying for the repose of his soul.
What I think people should know about the church in Africa is that the church is getting stronger. But the church in Africa cannot grow stronger in isolation.
The Catholic Church in Africa, the number of parishioners booming, and more vocations than there are positions to fill. Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we turn our attention to a continent where Catholicism is experiencing major growth. Correspondent Colin Flynn recently brought you a report on the massive March for the Martyrs in Uganda, where organizers say millions renewed their faith in honor of 22 Catholic martyrs who gave their lives more than a century ago to defend their religious beliefs. Colin traveled to several other African countries to get a deeper understanding of why the church is expanding so robustly, in contrast to dwindling numbers in other continents. In this report, a look at the Catholic Church in Kenya.
I'm Colin Flynn in Nairobi, Kenya. This East African country has a population of 54 million people. It's famous for its exotic wildlife, its bustling cities, its ethnic mix, its traditions and its cultures. And of the vast population, a third of all Kenyans are Catholic, with the largest archdiocese being right here in the capital, Nairobi.
The Catholic Church in Kenya traces its origins back to the late 19th century, when European missionaries arrived to evangelize. The church grew rapidly, focusing on the imminent needs, such as education and healthcare, and played a crucial role in social development when Kenya was colonized. Post-independence, the church in Kenya expanded its influence, becoming a prominent advocate for social justice and human rights, deeply embedding itself into the fabric of Kenyan life.
With Jesus Christ, our Lord.
Today, in the Archdiocese of Kisumu, they are celebrating almost 100 years of their founding, with the typical African colour and vibrancy. These dioceses, which were created by mainly white European missionaries, now have been handed over to the local people. Morris Muhatia Makumba is the Archbishop of Kisuma and seen as a rising star in the African church.
Faith is growing very fast in Africa, in Kenya. For example, we have a crisis of vocations, positive vocations to the priesthood. We have more candidates than places where they can go.
Wow, that's your crisis.
That's our crisis.
Too many.
Well, not too many, very many.
Today, there are hundreds of Catholic seminarians in Kenya undergoing formation for the priesthood. The numbers are rising each year, but the faith here is being challenged, and not just by influences from outside the country, but also from their very own culture and traditions.
Just like monogamy exists, mm-hmm. polygamy should exist as well.
Mm-hmm. Polygamy is a serious challenge. Polygamy is a serious challenge to the sacrament of marriage.
Is it still widely practiced here?
To a certain extent, yes. To a certain extent, yes. In my family, yes.
Oh, in your family too?
Yes.
Did your
my father was a polygamist.
Your father was?
Yes.
How many wives did he have?
Two.
Two?
Yes.
And were you from the first wife or the second?
The first.
The first wife.
That's right.
Polygamy, the practice of having multiple wives, is deeply rooted in Kenyan culture and serves various social, economic, and cultural functions. It often signifies wealth and social status, allowing men to create extensive family networks that can offer economic and labor support for the family. Another influence to the practice is the high mortality rate among children in many parts of Africa. And so having more children with more women further secured your lineage. However, modern influences and legal reforms are challenging its practice, pushing for gender equality and questioning its relevance in contemporary Africa today. And one of the largest voices opposing it is the Catholic Church.
We have had to form a group called St. Monica Widows. St. Monica Widows is supposed to look and take care of those ladies, women, who have lost their husbands. Because the other option is they are inherited culturally by somebody else. Inheritance...
You mean like a brother of the man who has died, yes, or a cousin would take them as a wife,
that's
an extra wife, okay?
Inheritance necessarily means polygamy. But there's no other way of looking at it, okay? It's quite a serious challenge. It's a cultural issue. But we are overcoming it slowly by slowly, because by forming this group of St. Monica Widows, more and more ladies are opting to join this particular group and refuse to be inherited. It is a very big challenge. Some of them are ostracized by their communities because of this. Some are rejected. Some lose all their inheritance because of that. They have no access to the property left behind by the husband. But some are quite courageous.
And if someone is in a polygamous relationship with a number of wives and they want to convert to the Catholic Church, what happens in that situation? Because the man has a responsibility now to a number of people and children he has to provide. How does the church handle that situation?
Actually, it has happened many ways, many times. He continues to provide for the family, but the personal relationship between himself and the lady is not there. Now, he lives only with the first wife.
In the eyes of the church, he was the legitimate first wife, and the first marriage stands. But is it difficult for the other women then if they want to come out of that relationship because they are then tainted in the village or the community? Would they be able to go on and marry again? Are they destitute to be on their own then?
In many cases, for example, many of these people already have many children. So the possibility of getting married again is slimmer. The faith holds for us values. The world should learn from us. We should not be taught by the world.
Many of the cultural beliefs and practices in Kenya are at odds with the teachings of the Catholic Church. And because they're so deeply rooted, it's been hard to eliminate them, even from within the Catholic Church. Father Don Bosco is a Kenyan member of the Congregation of the Holy Spirit, the Spiritans, and grew up here in Matungu village. I visited the village to meet Father Don Bosco and his father, George Odoro, who remembers how he felt when he realized his son had a vocation.
It was a good thing because we wanted to have priests. We were praying that if God grants us priests, so when he said he wanted to be a priest, I was happy. In fact, I concluded that God was answering our prayers.
His father may have been pleased with the idea of him joining the priesthood, but others in the village were not. It would be breaking a strong tradition of firstborn sons continuing the family lineage and having a large family. We visit the local church where Father Don Bosco went to as a child.
What about the part of you that thought, I want to have a family, I want to have children, and in my culture and in my family's tradition, it is very important for me as the firstborn son to continue the legacy?
Growing up, those realities were competing. In fact, when I completed my Form 4 and the results came out and I had qualified for university, I had to go into deeper thinking. That do I pursue a career and have myself married, have a family, or do I immediately, you know, go to the seminary and join priesthood. So I had these conflicting realities in my life.
Conflicting realities. That's where the Catholic Church in Kenya finds itself, in both conflicting with practices of the past and now new practices coming into Africa. The Vatican's recent controversial declaration,
Fiducia Supplicans,
which for the first time stated that blessings could now be given to people in same-sex unions, received a mixed reaction from around the world, but was strongly opposed here in Africa, where the bishops wrote to the Pope saying they would not be giving the blessings. One of those bishops is Philip Onyolo, Archbishop of Nairobi. When the Pope recently made the declaration that the Church could now bless same-sex couples, what was your reaction when you heard that?
Okay, my reaction here was like, let me listen, let me hear what the Holy Father says, and of course we have to obey the Holy Father. We do, even up to today, and onwards we shall never do the other ones. Africa will never disobey the Pope. But you know, the reaction was not even from the ordinary bishops, the priests. It was from the people.
What was the reaction?
People said the Catholic Church, our church, which is in our Catholic Church, is going to produce this now. Where shall we be? We are dead. We are finished.
So they couldn't believe it.
Initially, the reaction was not even particularly in the Catholic Church. It was in the other churches. What the Catholic Church is doing against the Catholic Church itself. What I know is very much obvious is this. Homosexuals is something that is coming in. LGBTs, those letters, I don't know whatever they mean. they are coming in.
Do you think it's something that the church in Kenya and wider in Africa will have to become more tolerant of, or do you think that they will stay steadfast against?
You know, the culture, when it comes to such unbecoming behavior, the culture is also very, very strong
against it.
It's against it, yeah.
While in the United States and in the West, the LGBT community is given rights, protection, and things like Pride Month, in most of Africa, it's a different story, but we'll focus on Kenya. Here, despite some objections by local activist groups, the issue of homosexuality is not seen as normal in society. And as Pope Francis insists, the Catholic Church should have a more welcoming tone when it comes to people in same-sex relationships, the church in Africa is not budging from their beliefs and their principles. The Pope's recent declaration on the blessing of same-sex people in same-sex unions, what was your reaction to that when you read that?
The reaction was to intensify catechesis on marriage.
But in your diocese here in the region, you would tell your priests that if anyone comes looking for this blessing, it's not to be given.
It is repugnant to the people, not only not to be given. It is repugnant. They will not come.
They won't come.
I know they will not come.
While some of the issues in society may be considered differently here than they are in the West, and many of the priorities of the Catholic Church here are different than they are in other parts of the world, what is undeniable is the vitality of the Catholic faith here in Kenya. And as that faith continues to grow, not just here, but in countries across the African continent, people are watching to see how the faith in Africa grows and develops and ultimately influences the global Catholic Church. In Kenya, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
EWTN News in Depth will have additional coverage in the weeks and months ahead on the Catholic Church in Africa. On the road with the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, we introduce you to the photographer who has a special knack for capturing the eternal here on Earth. This week marked the official halfway point of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. And as the perpetual pilgrims cross the country, we can reliably report many say, though physically tired, they are spiritually invigorated. The pilgrims are coming from four corners of the United States on routes east, west, north, and south, each named in honor of a spiritual intercessor. They will arrive in Indianapolis in mid-July in time for the National Eucharistic Congress, a Catholic gathering recognizing the source and summit of our Christian life, the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. Taking a look at some highlights from this week's pilgrimage routes, starting in the north, more than 2,000 pilgrims attended the procession at the Shrine of Our Lady of Champion, the site of the only approved Marian apparition in the U.S. and the namesake of the Northern Marian Route. Praying the rosary, pilgrims processed past the grave of Sister Adele Bryce, the woman who saw the apparition of Our Lady and whose cause for sainthood was officially opened by the U.S. bishops last week. Pilgrims in the South made it to Alabama this week, their fourth of eight states, marking the halfway point of the St. Juan Diego route. After celebrating Mass with Archbishop Thomas Rohde, more than 500 pilgrims processed through downtown Mobile, despite the 90-degree heat. The perpetual pilgrims spent a few days of recollection at the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, built by EWTN foundress Mother Angelica. Monse Alvarado will have more on the pilgrims' reflections next week. And on the eastern St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route, in the longest on-foot trek yet of all the pilgrimage routes, pilgrims made their way 17 miles through Beaver County, Pennsylvania. More than 200 people walked the entire journey in 95-degree heat, ending the long 8-hour day with overnight adoration. Pilgrims arrived in West Virginia on Thursday and will participate in a Eucharistic motorcade procession this weekend. And from the West St. Junipero Serra route this week, we are joined by EWTN contributor Jeff Bruno. Jeff has been taking beautiful still photography along several pilgrimage routes, which have been featured in our sister publications, the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. We thought we'd invite him on today, not only to introduce him to you, but to also show how he is capturing the spirit of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Jeff, welcome. Thank you for your beautiful work these past few weeks. I know you're home now, but I understand you were in America's heartland, Nebraska, earlier this week on the Serra route. So how many days have you spent following the various pilgrimage routes? And tell us about this week's experience at the Nebraska Land Days Field Mass.
Well, I guess I was there from the start. I guess around May 19th I began, so I don't know how many days, but it seems like every day almost, except there was a short break because my daughter got wedded, married in between. So I was home for that. But the Nebraska is an incredible place. It really is the heartland of America. And there's a lot that we can learn from there, you know, just in terms of their spirituality and their faith, how rooted they are. And the Field Mass, they have this thing called the Nebraska Field Mass. And it's a relatively new event, I guess you could say, or mass. They celebrate it out really in the middle of nowhere. It's to commemorate, there was an ambush there of a missionary priest and some troops back in 1740. And they do that to mark this. And it shows, you know, the Nebraskans kind of connecting back to their history, you know, to their historical mm-hmm. roots and whatnot. So it's really was a very, very... It revealed a lot about the character of the Nebraskan people and the Nebraska Catholic Church, I think.
Absolutely. And you set out, I understand, to capture a photo of a procession going through a field in Nebraska. Tell us, how did that story unfold?
Well, so I've never been to Nebraska before, but, you know, from conversations I've had and whatnot, I understood that, you know, it's very largely agricultural. And, you know, I was hoping for something, you know, some context, you know, the Blessed Sacrament, you know, Jesus being carried through a field, you know, something that was kind of iconic or, you know, an image that really reflects Nebraska. So I had gone there with that kind of stuck in my head. And it day after day, as I was there, it became more and more apparent that that was just not going to happen. Most of the churches are not located in the middle of fields. They're located in towns. So the processions that occurred within the town, the confines of the town. It wasn't up until the very end, it was the last day I was going to be there, that they had a problem with one of the routes. They was going to do a handoff from the Diocese of Grand Island to the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And they changed the route. And I remember I was driving in this little convoy because it was closed to the public because it's a very rough area. Mm-hmm. They thought it would be unsafe for pilgrims, you know, for the public, for general procession to go through. It would have been very challenging, especially for people who had difficulty walking. Mm-hmm. So as we're nearing this place, I see we switched from paved roads to dirt roads. And then before I know it, where I see this little rickety one-lane bridge, and then I see nothing but fields. Mm. And it was absolutely breathtaking to behold. It was a real gift, I thought, you know. And at the same time, I think God had it kind of planned that way, because I think I would have missed the bigger picture of who the Catholic, you know, community is in Nebraska had I... You know, I was kind of set on that, but then what happened in the meantime, while I was waiting for that shot to happen, which I didn't think would ever happen, I discovered the beauty, the simplicity, the piety, the purity, and the virtue of that Catholic community. And it is absolutely amazing. Maybe it's because they're so connected to nature, because, you know, because they grow things and they're connected to the Creator through that. I don't know. Well, I just know that America as a Catholic community, as a church, could learn a lot from Nebraska. Yeah.
Well, so. And those photos are an answered prayer of yours, and Jesus answered it in an unpredictable way, as he often does. Jeff, you and I were both on the East Seton route earlier this month when pilgrims visited the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton in Emmitsburg, Maryland. My videographer even caught you in action. Jeff, tell us, how do you approach your work on this pilgrimage, and how do you balance being a journalist on a job, but you're also a devout Catholic adoring our Lord in the Eucharist? How do you think about that?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's not that I go out as a photojournalist or a reporter or anything like that. I go out there as a Catholic trying to evangelize. I want to be able to present the beauty and the mission of the church to the world. And in this particular, this is a very unusual context, because we spend, you know, if you follow this, you know, if you're working with it, walking with the processions and everything, 4, 6, 8, 10 hours a day, you're in the presence of Christ. And that has a tremendous, a profound impact. So there's this, it's kind of like if the disciples were walking to Jerusalem, to Galilee, or to someplace like that, one of them was a photographer and trying to take pictures all the time. So it kind of, it's like we're walking with Christ, and at the same time, you know, trying to, you know, present him to the world in the Blessed Sacrament and the true presence at the same time. It's hard to describe. I mean, that's the best I could do, I think. So, but it's amazing. It's absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the disposition that you have that comes through in your photography. Jeff, finally, last question here, 1 minute left. Having visited the pilgrimage, is there one moment so far that stands out to you the most? Has there been a favorite event or a moment with especially stunning imagery?
You know, it's funny. I would love to say yes to that, but actually was, I think, something more profound than that. You know, but it was kind of, you know, it's through the photography that it kind of was revealed. But, and I go back to the point where when you spend this much time in the presence of Christ, there's an impact. Mm-hmm. It's like, and I mean, I notice it, you know, personally. I know that the pilgrims that I've spoken to and walked beside have noticed it personally. Father Landry has said some incredible things about it. He's a priest that's processing the entire Seton route. Mm-hmm. Said that it was a real adjustment for him to have Jesus 2 inches from his face, you know, through like hours and hours of processing and walking. I could just say this is that, you know, we're all in a state of convert, or we're all, you know, growing in faith. It's never a static moment. And this experience of being in the presence of Christ and doing this work has just had the most profound effect on me. And I hope and I pray that it's having the same effect on the country and on all the people that participate, and that we really do have a return to Christ and a appreciation for his presence, the gift of his presence and the Blessed Sacrament to all of us. So,
beautifully said. Beautifully said. Jeff, we are grateful for your work and for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Take care. God
you
bless.
You as well. The National Eucharistic Congress is just weeks away. To be a part of it all, register at ewtn.com/Eucharist, and you can receive a discounted pass. And if you cannot be there in person, EWTN will be providing coverage Wednesday through Sunday, July 17th through the 21st. I will be co-hosting along with Father Aquinas Gilbo, University Chaplain at the Catholic University of America, and Pete Burak, Vice President of Renewal Ministries. In-depth reporters Mark Irons and Roselle Regis will be there too to capture special event moments and the participant faith journeys. We hope you can join us in person or watch highlights right here on EWTN. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. We'll see you then.